From the studios at Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Cadet. You're listening to Idaho Matters. Well, it's Wednesday, which means it is time for our weekly Doctor Roundtable. This grew out of the COVID-19 pandemic, which started just over 3 years ago here in Idaho. Now, while we still struggle with cases of COVID and its variants, many folks are looking back over the past 3 years to try and figure out what we did right, but also what we did wrong, with an eye toward the next global outbreak of a virus. Dr. David Pate, who has hosted our Doctor's Roundtable since its infancy, and his good friend, Dr. Ted Epperle, just wrote a book that looks at the last 3 years of the pandemic. It also provides more than 100 recommendations that are designed to help everyone prepare for and survive the next outbreak. The book is called Preparing for the Next Global Outbreak, A Guide to Planning from the Schoolhouse to the White House, and it is available now. So joining us today are Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System, as well as Dr. Ted Epperle, President and CEO of Full Circle Health and a clinical professor of family medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle. I want to welcome both of you to the program.
Thank you, Jim.
So, Dr. Pate, I want to start with you. I am so curious how this book came about, because as I mentioned, you retired right before COVID-19 hit. You had all of these plans for retirement. All of a sudden, COVID hits. You literally have been on our air for the last 3 years. We are not the only news organization that you have been a part of. You also gave so much advice. I mean, basically, all of your time was spent on this pandemic. Where in the world, or how did you decide it was a good idea to write a book?
Well, you're quite right, Jim. I had wonderful plans for travel and spending time with my wife during that first year of retirement. And of course, it all went down the drain. And, you know, it started with the phone call I received from the governor in about a month after I retired, asking me if I would serve as an advisor to the state on our pandemic response. And then as it evolved from there, as I was trying to learn everything that I could, which really took a considerable amount of time, the rate at which new information was coming out, and also talking to experts and trying to learn things in the fields of virology and immunology and epidemiology and so forth. And then the rest of my time, I was just flooded with media calling for interviews because they were trying to get information out to the public. And it was, you know, hospitals were overwhelmed. The public health department was overwhelmed. So I was trying to step in and fill that gap, give interviews. And other people were calling me that run businesses and saying, you know, what do I do? Can I operate? Mm-hmm. How can I operate safely, et cetera? So it really was a 7 day a week job, and really almost every day. In May, my wife said, David, you ought to write a book. And I looked at her and I said, Lynette, I don't have any time to write a book. And so we went on with the pandemic, of course. And then in November, late November, as I recall, Dr. Epperle called me and he said, David, we need to write a book. And at that point, it kind of hit me, you know, my really good friend Ted and my wife both telling me that we should write a book. And I thought, because Ted and I discussed that, you know, it would have been so helpful to have a book like this written mm-hmm. about previous pandemics that he and I could use. So before Dr. Epperle got off the phone with me, I said, yes, let's do it.
And Dr. Epperle, let me bring you into the conversation, because I literally am holding a copy of the book in my hand. And I think it's important to point out that the book is based on the idea that another outbreak is coming. Now, can you explain, why you believe that, but also then the importance of really having a guidebook? Like, as Dr. Pate mentioned, I mean, there have been other books written about other pandemics, but I mean, I remember 3 years ago, really for the first time understanding anything about the Spanish flu epidemic, right? I mean, and it was a pandemic. we haven't kept good records, it seems. And so then you're reinventing the wheel.
That's right, Gemma. The reason that there will be other pandemics, and probably in not too short order, are a couple large scale factors. One is the world's population is getting more and more by the day. With climate change, we're seeing more people being crowded together as some land mass starts to disappear. We are in closer contact with animal populations than we have been in the past. And so we've got a bit of a perfect storm, Gemma, with the fact that more people closer together, more animal populations, passing viruses back and forth. It's kind of a cauldron, a perfect stew, if you will, for these sorts of viruses to both mutate and then to start to have human infection that can rise to this level. Why I think that David and I were interested in the topic wasn't that we're going to, not that we're going to prevent the next pandemic, but how do we be prepared for the next pandemic? So our focus was more on let's learn from this. Let's think through the things that both went well and didn't go well. And let's help all sorts of organizations, again, from the schoolhouse to the White House, be better able to prepare for this.
I want to read something from chapter two, which is titled Pandemic Surveillance and Early Response in the Future. And it's really this quote by James Thurber that is at the top of this. And it says, "Let us not look back in anger or forward in fear, but around in awareness." Dr. Pate, that struck me to my core because I feel as if that is exactly what's happened. We look back and so many people are angry about what happened and didn't happen, right? Then there's this fear of, oh my gosh, are we going to go through something like this again? But talk about this awareness, because I think that this is where you and Dr. Epperle have done such a good job in this book, is it's like, we can't change the past. There's no reason to fear the future if we can learn from this.
Well, well said, Gemma. And I just want to credit Dr. Epperle. It was his idea for us to choose a quote that we thought would be somewhat profound and apply to the lesson we're trying to make in that chapter. And so I credit him with that idea. And I think we did select some really good quotes here that try to sum up the point. And the point is exactly as you're saying. When people are afraid of things, they tend to, our minds tell us to get away from thinking about it, you know, try to get our minds on something else or use our minds to minimize that fear, somehow to reassure ourselves. That's not going to serve us well in the future. And the same thing is that there are certainly a lot of people angry about various things that happened with this pandemic on both sides of the aisle. Those that are angry that thinking we went too far, and those that are angry thinking that we didn't go far enough, such as the immunocompromised people. So I think that what we have to do is we have to be objective about it, because I totally agree with Dr. Epperle. It is, you know, the odds are certainly, if you just look at the progression of last pandemics, the odds are we're going to have another pandemic very likely within a decade. And one thing I can tell you is it's almost assuredly going to be very different than this one. And what I'm afraid is that people now think this is what a pandemic is like. A pandemic could be like this, but it could be very different. For example, I've said on your show many times that I can think of a dozen viruses off the top of my head that have pandemic potential, but would have mortality rates, you know, 10, 30, 40 times what the mortality rate was for COVID. And that will change things. So really what our purpose is, we want to do a couple things. Number one, in the first chapter, the reason we recount what happened with COVID, because this is not really a book about COVID, but the reason we recount that is so many people have already forgotten what happened. And certainly by the time the next pandemic happens, many will have forgotten. So we want to chronicle that. And then what we want to do is just say, look, there are practical things that we can do. And in fact, most of the recommendations that we come up with should not be politically offensive to either party. They are rational things that we can do to improve the next response, because we could be dealing with a virus with much higher mortality rate, or we could be dealing with a virus that in fact does the opposite, whereas this time it particularly disadvantaged the elderly. The next virus could be one that particularly goes after our kids. And so we just need to make sure that we think about this rationally, and let's take control of it. Let's just prepare and learn the lessons. And I'm afraid that all too often history has taught us we don't learn those lessons.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Epperle, one of the repeating themes in the book is the idea of herd immunity. excuse me. And this came up so much during the pandemic, right? It's like, well, you just need herd immunity and that'll get the job done. First off, remind us what herd immunity is. How did it come up during the pandemic? And frankly, why it is not a good idea?
Yes. What herd immunity is by having enough of the immune response of all people collectively as a herd, if you will, be high enough, Gemma, either by having had the virus or getting vaccinated against the virus, that there is enough collective human immunity to protect then the rest of society that has not either been infected nor have been vaccinated. So typically herd immunity will happen at either vaccination or infectivity rates greater than 70%. Sometimes it can be higher than that. But that is what is termed as herd immunity. In this particular virus, it was a novel virus, a new virus. It had never been seen before by human experience. And so it was going to take a large amount of time, if you will, to develop a collective herd immunity. Hence why it was so important to act early in regards to the virus for two reasons. One is to protect the elderly and the really young people because we didn't know how this was going to be. As David pointed out, we didn't know what the lethality rate was really going to look like in the early stages of this. We were fortunate that it was only at about a 1% level. It easily could have been potentially higher than that. And so all these efforts to be done early was to protect the most vulnerable in societies, as well as to protect the health system and the hospitals from not being overrun. What can happen in a pandemic with a new virus where there is no herd immunity, no vaccine, no prior infectivity of people, is you get such a large amount of people getting sick, Gemma, that all of a sudden the health system and the hospitals get overrun. Now, why that can be a problem, a major problem, is then there is no care for all the other routine things that people may need a hospital for. Mm-hmm. Heart attacks, motor vehicle accidents, other infective diseases, exacerbation of emphysema and asthma. And so all of a sudden, you shut down the very system that can be life-saving for many people with all sorts of problems. So not only is there a problem with the virus and the pandemic itself, but it closes down all the other avenues of healthcare And that's why this became a big deal early, with no herd immunity and no ability to really control this. Then the public health measures were all that stood between that particular scenario of hospitals being overrun, a lot of infection, a lot of unnecessary potential death to the elderly and the immune compromised people. And that's why public health initiatives, masking, social distancing, group size limitations, good hand washing, all of that became our only defense mechanism.
So in the book, you give 117 recommendations. Dr. Pate, who are those recommendations for?
Yeah, so it really, the recommendations are particularly aimed at all the different groups that have to be involved in managing a public health emergency or a pandemic. And so we really divide them up. Although during the book, we write the whole narrative. And as mm-hmm. we've talked about, we talk about the reminder of what we went through with COVID, but also then go into a lot of specific topics. You mentioned one, herd immunity. We talk a lot about that. And through that narrative, we develop these recommendations, the 117 recommendations. But then at the in the last chapter, we divide them out for quick reference based on who they are aimed at. So, for example, we have some recommendations that would be for the World Health Organization and how we approach things globally, which obviously has to change. We have recommendations for those in federal government, things that they should consider doing differently. We have recommendations for state governments of things they should consider doing or doing differently. And we have recommendations for local city governments, for health systems and hospitals, and particularly for schools, because we saw that in so many cases, school boards and school leaders seem to be not well prepared for dealing with this. So they are, and that's why we say in our subtitle, it's a guide to planning from the schoolhouse to the White House. Mm-hmm. So any of those groups that are involved in planning, I think this would be helpful for, but also people that just want to try to understand this and so that they can prepare themselves, because I think a lot of the public has realized that so often they were pretty much on their own to because there was so much disinformation out there and there was so much distrust of the CDC. I think that's where your radio show came in handy, that we could actually answer people's questions and give them good information. But if somebody wants to understand these concepts like herd immunity and some of the other things that happened during this and understand about viruses, this book will give them a good understanding of the issues and why we make the recommendations.
And Dr. Epperle, I want to go back to where you and I left off in the last segment when you were discussing herd immunity, which was controversial. You also, in the book, dive into some other issues that became heavily controversial during the pandemic. This was things like travel bans, mask mandates, even social media's role during the outbreak. So I know in the book you have some recommendations around them. So why is it important, first off, to get fact-based scientific information to the public, but also how in the world do we do that? Because it was like fighting an uphill battle, making sure people got actual factual information that was based in science.
Yeah, one of the big insights to the book, I think, Gemma, is it's all about communication. Either the clarity and trustworthiness of that or the lack of that. Where we started to get off track almost from the get-go was at the national leadership level. There was not a clear and consistent message. It was confusing and chaotic, and there was backtracking on the message, even from the CDC. And so it led to chaos. And when there's chaos or confusion, then what can happen is people start to develop their own narratives. And we saw this in spades, especially with the amplification by social media. So depending on your news source of preference, you could get almost any message on this topic of COVID-19 and the pandemic and the public health initiatives that you desired. There were pundits galore. And what David and I both witnessed, as we all did, I think, across the nation, was that not only was there misinformation in terms of wrong information being given, non-factual, not evidence-based, but also maybe more damaging disinformation, where it was purposefully and with intent to create certain responses in segments of society that led then to the politicization of this, the polarization of this, the division in society that happened because of this. So in essence, instead of being pulled together nationally and acting in the best interests of the public writ large, what started to happen is that the nation started to become divided over this. And there was, instead of us talking about facts and trying to work together for the public's interest, it started to be almost a war where not only were ideas being attacked, but people were being attacked. And all of a sudden, it led to a total loss of cohesion in our abilities to work together as a society.
You know, Dr. Pate, I think something that sometimes gets lost in what happened during the pandemic is really the racial and ethnic disparities that are in the U.S. health system. And I think sometimes it's easy to gloss over that if you are not in one of those groups. It became very evident during the pandemic that we have a broken healthcare system when it comes to racial and ethnic disparities. You write about this in the book. Why was it important for you to make sure that there's an entire chapter dedicated to this, but then also recommendations on how you go about making sure hopefully something like this doesn't happen again during the next pandemic, or frankly, not even in a pandemic, that we shouldn't have these disparities?
Well, you're exactly right, Gemma. And, you know, Dr. Epperle and I and all healthcare leaders have known for at least a decade, probably longer, that there are many disparities in our healthcare system. And those disparities actually lead to worse outcomes for those of healthcare, for those that are affected. And what we saw during the pandemic is those disparities were amplified and much worse. And everybody with open eyes could see it. If you had a white collar job, there was a good chance you could work from home. If you didn't, if you had a lower paying job and certain, factory jobs, butchering plant jobs, other things, you had to show up to work. And of course, we all understand it, that there are those kinds of differences. And we're not saying that, you know, we can just cure all of those disparities overnight. But we need to think about those and think how we can lessen those disparities and how, especially during a pandemic, we can protect those people that don't have the luxury to work from home. Because when they do get sick, then they are posing the risk of further transmitting this in their own families, as well as it can be to an entire manufacturing plant or whatever it is, and you could end up in that you know, plant or that factory being shut down. It's in our own interests to make sure that in a pandemic, everyone has access to healthcare, everyone has access to testing, and because otherwise we're going to end up with some of the severe problems that we had with this. And as we've said, the next pandemic could be far worse than this. And so, you know, we have to understand that people that are working in these jobs where they have to be physically present, they usually don't have sick time or don't have much of it. So what does that mean? Mm-hmm. That means even if they get infected, they have to go back to work, or they can't take time off work. And they're just posing a further aggravation to the public risk of controlling the spread of the infection. Also, if they get symptoms while they're at work, they usually cannot take off from work to go to the doctor. And if you don't have testing there at the site or something very convenient for them, they're not going to get tested. They're going to be sick and they're going to be exposing other people. So we really think this is an important issue that needs to be addressed. And that's why we devoted an entire chapter. And in fact, Dr. Epperle wrote that chapter because of his passion around it. And I thought he just really made excellent points.
Mm-hmm. I think it's such a necessary part of the book. I want to talk a little bit now about the fact that there's an entire chapter dedicated to health departments. You have 12 recommendations, Dr. Epperle, around getting health departments ready for the next pandemic. We should note you were on a health department board for many, many years here in Idaho, and then the pandemic hit. So how did Idaho's health department system fare under COVID? And what do we need to change, not just locally, but when we look at, you know, health departments as a whole?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jim. I'm glad you're bringing this up. For 15 years, I was the single physician on our Central District Health Department board. Each of our seven health districts in Idaho is required to have one physician member. And then the rest of the health board is made up of either county commissioners or other people that the county commissioners put in place. What we saw happen during the pandemic was a failure of our public health department system. And it happened fairly quickly and at multiple levels. The key piece that started a cascade was when the governor of our state, Governor Little, made the decision that we would decentralize the control of and response to the pandemic to the local health departments. And so instead of having one centralized effort around masking or isolation or around community size limitations, we then delegated that to seven health districts. The seven health districts, as I just mentioned, were a composition of different people from the community, and they were not always on the same page. I'll just use ours as an example. Myself and one of our county commissioners, Diana Lacciando, were very in favor of public health initiatives to help get immediate, quick control over the spread of the pandemic to protect, again, those at risk and to help make sure that the hospital systems didn't get overrun. On the other hand, there were many other members of our health district board that absolutely looked at that differently. They felt this was an absolute infringement on civil liberties. And who were we to try to tell people in the community that they needed to wear a mask or have limitations on community gatherings? And it kind of became obvious that we had split into a camp of supporters of public health and the initiatives necessary, especially without vaccination or other strategies to help protect people, versus those who felt that that was important, and those who felt that, no, the important piece is to keep the economy running, to keep businesses open, and to not tell people what to do, and to not infringe on civil liberties. And so what happened because of the lack of a centralized response at the state level was a decentralized patchwork of chaos, where each of the seven health districts then, depending on the makeup of their health department boards, opted to go their own direction, which led to an incredible disarray of organized activity. Hence why then we had a lot of people that didn't need to get sick, a lot of people who didn't need to die, who died. And so it becomes one of our fundamental recommendations is around the public health departments. And to take a look at the structure of those health departments, who constitutes them, what are the qualifications of members that sit on public health departments, what were the things that need to happen in the time of a pandemic like this, and how we can better educate and shore up the infrastructure of the health departments. The health department, Central District Health, got devastated by this pandemic. And our own internal friction within our department board of directors only enhanced the chaos within the health department that was truly acting admirably for the best interests of the public. And with that, Jim, I'll stop at this point.
So, Dr. Pate, you know, everything Dr. Epperle said about the health department and the, quote, chaos that happened, it also felt that way when it came to state government and federal government, because we have a system, you know, that's set up that very rarely does the federal government get to come in and tell a state what to do. With that said, that seemed to cause even more chaos when you had, you know, a state like Idaho that was very lax, but then you go across the border to Oregon and Washington, and they were, you know, very strict on their mandates. And that caused just so much friction. So you talk about this in the book as well. How then do we go about making recommendations for the next pandemic in how state governments and federal government work together?
Yeah, you bring up an important point. And, it was a particular impact because during a pandemic, people don't stay in their own state. They travel to other states. And in our case, we had Idahoans getting very sick with COVID and having to spill over into neighboring state hospitals because of times when our capacities were exceeded. And that meant that our citizens were just adding to the stresses those other states were dealing with. So it was obvious that, you know, this was going to create tension. There's other examples as well where I've been planning for pandemics as a hospital and then a health system CEO, you know, for the past 15 years. And I always thought that if we had a problem, the federal government would be right there to help with the national strategic stockpiles. It never occurred to me that there was almost nothing left in the strategic national stockpiles. And so, you know, you remember back to those images, particularly like think about New York City back in early 2020. And we saw pictures of nurses wearing garbage bags as their PPE because they ran out of gowns and couldn't get those. We saw all kinds of problems that emerged because of this lack of coordination. I remember being on calls as part of the governor's work group with the federal government, and we were having arguments about purchasing supplies because the federal government was having states do their own purchasing while they were doing purchasing. And so we ended up competing with each other and just driving prices up as we were trying to get things. And even poor hospitals had and medical groups had to enter the bargaining against other countries. And of course, you know who's going to win out in that. So, you know, we have so many things that we point out in the book. And again, these shouldn't be political, but things like the supply chain. How are we going to ensure we protect the supply chain? How are we going to deal with the issue that we can't count on the federal government? Should we have our own state stockpile? And we give a recommendation for a novel idea of how we could do that and make that cost effective. So there's just a lot of things that we have to work out. And we're Dr. Epperle and I are trying to bring those to the forefront and get these discussions and these plannings going.
So both of you live and you have worked for many years in Idaho. I am curious about what Idaho did and did right and did wrong, because you both write in the book quite a bit about Idaho and how we dealt with the pandemic. So Dr. Epperle, I want to start with you, and then Dr. Pate, I'll go to you. But Dr. Epperle, in your opinion, what did we get right, but what did we get wrong? And then what do we need to do the next time?
Yeah, thank you, Gemma. Great question. Let me start with kind of where we got off track as a state, I think. If we think of Idaho and the Intermountain West in particular, it's a younger part of our nation than our either coast, especially the East Coast. And so what we saw happen on the East Coast for the most part was much more of a mature response, where the collective good of the people were being looked after. There was a social norming, if you will, on the value and importance of public health. Out in the West, especially the Rocky Mountain West, states that David and I and you, Gemma, love, we saw a much more of a libertarian mindset of both anti-government sentiment and don't tell us what to do, and much more of a, if you will allow me, an angry adolescent response to the pandemic around my rights, my liberties, my infringements, versus this collective mature response of we're all in this together, let's take care of our fellow citizens. So we kind of got off track, if you will, with both the ideology and the mindset of how does a population of people come together in a crisis. And that was where I would point out where Idaho struggled a bit. Where Idaho, I think, did well with this is that we all are a small state. We can communicate with each other, I think, effectively. We can pull in to help our neighbor. It allowed, I think, the government's, the governor, some degree of comfort to know that there were 7 public health districts. Let's get the control of this down to the local level. Let's let each of the health departments in conjunction with its communities manage this. I think that was a wonderful idea. It didn't play out well, of course, for the reasons we've talked about a little bit earlier on the segment. But I think the idea of Idaho working together is both a strength, but in this particular case, a weakness. Because we do know, and I'll end with this additional thought. One of the other strengths of Idaho is that we all know each other pretty well in regards to at the health systems level. So it allowed us to communicate, I think, relatively effectively from hospital to hospital, from physician group to physician group, from the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare, our state epidemiologist, Dr. Hahn. All of those things allowed us in conjunction with the public health departments to exchange information with each other. And that was some of the good stuff that happened with the pandemic. And Jim, I'll stop with that.
And Dr. Pate, I would like your thoughts on this. We have about 5 minutes left in our program today. But what did Idaho get right? And where do we go from here the next time we find ourselves in a pandemic?
Yeah, let me praise a few organizations for their work during the pandemic. First of all, I think people need to understand that Idaho is blessed with our public health workers, those in the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare and those at these health districts. And I'm talking here about the regular employees, epidemiologists, medical doctors, others that work in those fields. First of all, the people involved in contact tracing, they endured a lot of abuse, and yet they gave us so much important information about what was happening to the disease in Idaho so we could adjust our plans. There were many states that faltered with their vaccine rollout. We had a relatively very good vaccine rollout, and that's because we have such a strong vaccine program with the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare. Another point that I would make is there were a lot of states that had problems with their reporting, the accuracy of their reporting of vaccines delivered, cases, all kinds of things. Our data reporting was stellar, and a lot of that credit goes to Dr. Kathy Turner, who reviewed essentially every case to determine what really was a COVID death, what wasn't, what was a reinfection, what wasn't, et cetera. She's amazing. So we have amazing professionals. One of my regrets is that because of the public hostility, we've lost a lot of great people, and we have to encourage people to go into public health. The other group that I want to commend is all of our healthcare organizations. You know, before the pandemic, and I can tell you leading St. Luke's, it was very competitive. And but during the pandemic, I applaud healthcare providers because they all came together and they worked to help each other. And especially a lot of the professionals that work in the units taking care of COVID people, they endured a lot of abuse. In some cases, they endured personal attacks, verbal and otherwise, and yet their dedication and commitment to taking care of people was amazing. So yes, there are things that we got wrong. Yes, there's things that we can improve on, and Dr. Epperle and I write extensively about those, but there were a lot of good things, and our public health and our healthcare systems were amazing. I'd also just end by saying that not only were healthcare leaders at St. Luke's and St. Al's focused on just taking care of people during this pandemic, they also volunteered their time to advise schools. Most often that advice wasn't taken, but they spent considerable amount of time to advise schools, and I'm just so proud of them.
Well, I want to thank both of you for taking the time today to talk to us more in depth about this, and all of the work that the two of you did over the last 3 years in forming all of our community. Thank you so very much for everything that the two of you have done. So I thank you. We thank you here at Boise State Public Radio News.
Thank you, Gemma.
We have been talking. Absolutely. We have been talking about the new book, Preparing for the Next Global Outbreak, with the authors, Dr. David Pate, who is the former CEO of St. Luke's Health System. Of course, he has been here on the Dr. Roundtable since the very beginning, as well as Dr. Ted Epperle, President and CEO of Full Circle Health. And he's also a clinical professor of family medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
What if the greatest tragedy of your life was just covered up?
I've never seen anything like that before or after.
This is the story of the worst marine-on-marine friendly fire in modern history, a story kept from the public.
It's like What did y'all have to hide?
Listen to NPR's Embedded podcast in its latest series, Taking Cover.